For this evening's Dhamma talk, as usual, that I've been inviting some suggestions. I know that I talked to the receptionist, I asked, what should I talk about? She said, nothing. I've done that before. But there was a fax to me that somebody, I forget who they were, was saying, can I please talk about the idea of dreams in Buddhism? And as I was just reflecting, that twice this week other people have talked about dreams and asked me their significance. So, this is this evening's talk, Dreams and Buddhism. So those of you who are very tired, you can actually go to sleep and you can give me some more input afterwards about what I'm supposed to talk about. But we always say that practice is much better than listening to things. But one of the main reasons people ask about dreams is because sometimes people have these strange dreams. And are those strange dreams, are they real or are they just fantasy? And what place do what we call like prognostic dreams have in Buddhism? I'm not sure if any of you have had these dreams. And sometimes they've been so clear, so vivid, that you remember them easily when you wake up. And they leave an impression in your mind, and later on you find that they do bear some relation to the real world. It's somehow or other that those dreams which we have do convey some legitimate information. And many, many stories about that. And of course during this talk I'll give some of those stories, some funny stories, some scary stories, but all interesting stories. But the first story I'm going to mention about dreams is just how unreliable they are. Because one of my friends, who I became a monk with, he was an American. You know, because we were monks together, we'd always be chatting and talking about what was happening. And he said that throughout his life, he'd always had these dreams, which later on turned out to be true. He said, as a young man living in California, in Pasadena, his father was quite wealthy, so they had quite a big house with a swimming pool. He'd always have this recurring dream, he told me, that his younger sister would fall into the swimming pool, drown, and die. And he said, one day he was just, as a young 16 or 17 year old, he was just sitting around the pool, just doing nothing. And then the dream which he had seen so often started to unfold. It was exactly as he dreamt. But because he remembered the dream and knew what was going to happen next, he actually intervened and saved his sister's life. And he said it was weird, but if he hadn't had that dream, his sister would be dead. And that gave him such confidence in dreams, especially in those vivid types of dreams, that he believed in them, except for once when he said he was maybe about 21, 22, and he was in New Zealand. Remember, this was 30, 40 years ago. Shows how old I am. But this was a time when young people were really into smoking marijuana. And he was in a house over in New Zealand with a few other young people, you know, sort of taking those recreational drugs. And he had a dream, he said many times, that the New Zealand police came into the house and arrested everybody. And he said he was kicking himself because he never took preventative action. And it happened, and he got deported. And so he had two dreams, he said, which actually turned out to be true. And he said the third dream, which he had, and this was the one he kept on telling me. This was in 1974 when I became a monk. And it was just towards the end of the Vietnam War. And the Viet Cong had taken over Vietnam, Pathet Lao had taken over Laos, and the Khmer Rouge had taken over Cambodia. And our monasteries were very, very close, you know, to the border between Cambodia and Laos, right in that sort of west-northwest corner of Thailand. And I remember looking at a map once, and the distance from my monastery in Thailand to Bangkok was twice the distance as it was to Hanoi. We're much closer to Hanoi, let alone the other sort of communist places. And there was an evacuation plan, which we had to register for our embassies. because most Western diplomats at the time subscribed to what was called the domino theory. They thought once Vietnam, Laos and Cambodia fell, Thailand would be next, especially the northeast where we were, very close. And so he thought he had this dream of the communist soldiers invading that part of Thailand, him running away across a paddy field and getting shot in the back of the head. And he was so convinced of that dream, he said, that's how I'm going to die. I know I'm going to die. The communists are going to invade and I'm going to be caught and killed. Because two times he got it right. But that never ever happened. You know, he disrobed, fell in love, got married, and 1 year after he got married, he got killed in a head-on car crash in California. So it never worked out. But always remember that sometimes these dreams, you do get it right, and sometimes you don't. Which is why the first thing to know about dreams is you cannot rely upon them. But sometimes they do tell you the truth. Of course, the classic tale, and many of you have hopefully know this tale, because you bought that excellent book which is available in the library called Open the Door of Your Heart. And this was a tale here in Perth, this amazing tale about this fellow who had, again, one of these very vivid dreams early one morning. I know if you ask the monks in Thailand about these dreams, they always say the reason you have these vivid dreams early in the morning is because you're sleeping too much. Because we don't sleep very much as monks. We're supposed to get up at 4 o'clock in the morning, every morning. And that's been quite lazy, because in Thailand we had to get up at 3 o'clock in the morning. So, you know, I never used to dream when you were asleep. I actually used to dream when you were meditating, getting up at 3 o'clock in the morning, but not when you were asleep. So, down in our monastery, we get up at 4 o'clock every morning. But, as I tell many people, getting up at four in a monastery is optional. You can always get up earlier if you want to. That's the only option. But this person, sort of in Perth, he had one of his vivid dreams. And this dream was of these five angels. These five angels, and you can dream these amazing dreams, and each angel had five pots of gold, like these big, almost like vases, like these urns which we have in the monastery for people's ashes, but this was in gold. Gold was inside. And they lined up and gave this guy five pots of gold each. And especially, you know, with the falling dollar and the rising gold, that would be worth a fortune. And so he woke up, and of course the first thing he did was look around, and there was no angels in his room, but even worse, no gold. It was just a dream. But one of those very vivid dreams, which, you know, he got dressed, had a shower, it was just playing in his mind when he went down for breakfast. And he couldn't believe that at his breakfast table, his wife had made him five boiled eggs with five pieces of toast. And he was wondering, what's with this magic number five? Five angels, five pots of gold, five boiled eggs and five bits of toast. And you can imagine what he felt when he looked at the morning newspaper, the morning West Australian. It was the 5th of May. The 5th month. So thinking, this is really weird, he looked in the horse racing. You know the horse racing course just south of the river, Ascot? A-S-C-O-T. Five letters. And he couldn't believe his eyes when he saw in race number five that afternoon, in race number five, horse number five was called Five Angels. He was there. Five Angels was running. Horse number five, race number five. And of course, these sorts of dreams, they only happen, if ever, only once in your lifetime. So he thought, he can't waste this opportunity. He never told his wife, because sometimes the girls don't understand these things. That's what he thought anyway. But he did take the afternoon off work, before going to the racetrack, he went to the bank and he drew out $5,000. Well, if you're going to do it, you might as well win big or not at all. You only have one chance in a lifetime. 5,000, because you want to keep the lucky number 5, 5,000. When he went to the racetrack, he chose a fifth bookmaker to keep the lucky number 5, $5,000 to win. Horse number 5, race number 5, 5 angels. The lucky number 5 could not be wrong. It wasn't wrong. His horse came in 5th. which just goes to show you that dreams, they're true, but you sometimes misinterpret them and get them wrong. Or just like another couple who, oh, they came to a monastery every Thursday afternoon, and they're a lovely couple. They were there yesterday giving us some food. And when I told that story to him, he told his story, because we've all got these little stories about dreams. And his story was, again, an interesting one where he did get a correct dream, but some other people misinterpreted it too. Because he was an Englishman. He was in the British Army. He was just not a fighter. He was like a dental technician or something. So, you know, pretty sort of easy job. But he was posted off to Singapore when the British were still in Singapore. And there he met this nice girl and married her. So he had a Singapore wife. And they moved down to live in Perth, where they've been living for many years. And he told me that once when he was visiting Singapore, you know, with his wife's family, and his wife was chatting, nag, 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 and he got really bored, you know, talking about all this stuff. You know what it's like, you know, meeting, you know, your other partner's, your partner's family. So, well, they were all sort of talking and chatting and eating. He was getting very bored, and his brothers-in-law saw that and said, look, we're going to the racetrack this afternoon. We'd like to come along. And he never likes gambling or going to the racetrack, but that was much better than facing his wife's family. So he said, okay, I'll go. So they took him to the racetrack, but this is Singapore, Chinese Buddhists. Before you go to the racetrack, you have to visit the lucky temple. So they went to a lucky temple, you know, in the back streets of Singapore somewhere. And as soon as they walked in, it was a mess. You know, it was just ash everywhere, papers and stuff. So, and this is an important part of this process. If you're going to be lucky, you've got to do some good karma, first of all. Please remember that. So if ever you go to the racetrack or the casino, come to Dhammaloka Center and do some sweeping or some weeding, first of all. Otherwise, you've got no chance. So, he went to the temple, and they saw it was a mess, so they spent about half an hour or an hour cleaning the place up. And once they cleaned the place up, then, you know what those, we call them Jostic Buddhists, you know, in our tradition, getting a few Jostics. And no one actually knows why they do this. They just do that because their grandmother did it. And they don't know what it is. It doesn't make any difference how much you shake these things. But anyway, they did the shake of the Jostics, and they put it in the whatever it is, the Jostic holder. And then they went over, because we don't do this sort of stuff in the forest tradition is very simple and very rational. We don't have all this superstition stuff. But nevertheless, I know that, I don't know why this is or where this came from. In all these lottery outlets in Perth, you have these big fat Buddhas and you're supposed to rub their tummy for luck. I don't know what you do that for. And sometimes I'm getting a bit fat now, and sometimes people come up and they want to rub my belly. No way. Anyway, actually, I did open a lottery stall. I'm just really going off the course here, because sometimes as a monk, people, friends say, you know, they're opening up a new business or going into a new house, and sometimes it's part of a tradition. You know, come and invite a monk to actually to bless the place. So some time ago, they said, oh, my friend, they're opening up a new shop in some shopping centre. I better not tell you which one it is. And so I said, okay, yeah. They never told me it was a lottery shop. And you're not supposed to get involved in these sorts of things as monks. You know, we're supposed to tell people not to gamble. And it's, but the Buddha actually said gambling is like is an addiction. It's the wrong thing to do. But nevertheless, I got caught that way, and I was there, and just, gee, I should have asked what shop I was going to be blessing. Well, one day people will ask me to bless a pub, or sometimes even worse, if I don't ask. But anyway, I went into the place, and it was too late now, so I did a bit of blessing. But actually, a couple of weeks later, they got a jackpot there. So these blessings are really good. But anyhow, where was I? I was back in this Singapore. Singapore. So they cleaned up the temple. And they did lots of good karma. And they went to the racetrack. It's amazing. You know, the result. They all lost. But nevertheless, they had a bit of fun. But that night, this Englishman married to a Singapore girl, he had a dream. And again, one of these very clear dreams, which you remember. And so he woke up from the dream, guess what it was? He dreamt of a horse race. You know, seeing it in his dream. And he dreamt the horse which won, the name of that horse. This is a true story. He remembered that name when he woke up. And just for interest, look in the morning paper, the Straits Times, in the horse racing. It was running that day. Exactly that name. So the first thing he did, you know, being fair, he rang up all his brothers-in-law and said, hey, that temple which we blessed, or we cleaned up the other day, there must be some sort of heavenly being or some spirit guarding the place, because they told me the name of the horse which is going to win today. And it's in, look, this is the name, it's in the Straits Times, they're racing today. Let's all go to the racetrack, we get our money back, which we lost yesterday, and make a bit more. Sounds reasonable. But his brothers-in-law said, listen, so you're what we call an Ang Mo. People are laughing here. No, that means like redhead. That means like a Westerner, like a foreigner in Singapore. He said, that was a Singapore temple. Any spirit there, they would not tell one of you guys, certainly not an English guy. They would tell us. We never had any dreams. So you're just imagining it, they said. So because they thought that a Singaporean, like a Chinese spirit, would never tell an English person, they never went to the track. He went alone. And that horse won. And he put a lot of money on it, because he was convinced, he dreamt it. And that horse won, and he made a lot of money. What he lost yesterday was insignificant to what he won. And the worst thing was that when he went home and he told his brothers, hey, that horse I told you about, it won that day, it made a lot of money. Oh, his brothers-in-law, they were ropeable, they were so upset and angry, not at him, but at the Singapore spirits. They don't look after their own, look after these visitors, these blow-ins from Australia. They help them, never the guys who sort of worship in the temple every week. They were really upset. So these are like true stories, but how does it work? And how do these things actually happen? Because when you're actually sleeping, when you do have a vivid dream, now your mind is actually working and it's not so oppressed by all these thinking and worrying and planning, which you do most of the time. Your poor mind has got no freedom. Just look at what you've been doing today and how much freedom your mind has. Instead, you're so busy thinking, planning, like I've been doing today at our retreat center. Thinking, planning, remembering, doing so much. Very rarely does your brain have space to actually touch anything else. Of course, when you learn how to meditate, there's another way of getting this sort of ability of the mind to be a little bit more perceptive, a little bit more sensitive. But for many people, they can't do that in meditation, but at least when they're dreaming. It means that all of the controls, all of the, even the fears, which stop you from actually investigating interesting things, all those things tend to disappear, be taken away in a dream state. And especially in the early morning, because when the brain has sort of, it's got its energy back, and it's had its sleep, and it's got energized, but you're not really awake because you're not really controlling anything at that time. You've got the mental energy, you're about to wake up, but you're not controlling things. And that's got the time when the mind can actually sort of be a bit more sensitive. It's amazing just because of how much we control our mind and force it and block it up, we can't be sensitive. So it's one of the things which you learn as a monk. Learning how to be still and silent, let go of all the thinking and all the planning and all the remembering, and be really still. You can get incredibly sensitive. You can pick up things, pick up some weird things sometimes. But that's just part of a still mind, a powerful mind. But many times people do this in the early morning just before they wake up. The controller was gone, the mind is energized, and you can sometimes become sensitive. The thing is that sometimes it is just a fantasy, just a dream, and sometimes it's a real thing. And that you can't tell which one it is. That's the trouble with these dreams. But it can happen sometimes. And also, it's a time when other beings can actually contact you. In the sense that if a ghost came up now, I mean, you'd run a mile. You know, if some sort of other spirit came along and said, hey, sort of, I want to tell you what your future's going to be. You know, people would be terrified because it's really weird, human beings, that with anything which we're unsure of, which we don't know, we get afraid of. It's just a fear of the unknown. And after a while, especially if you've been a monk, or if you listen to these things and have a bit of confidence, you know, you don't have to be afraid of anything. I don't know how many people are afraid of ghosts. But I was telling somebody the other day that when I was at university at Cambridge, I joined three societies. The first society was a Buddhist society, because I was a Buddhist even then, and there was a very thriving Buddhist community in Cambridge, only sort of a group of us, you know, maybe 20, 30, 40, but we were very active. That's where I first learned my meditation. So that was the first society I joined, was the Buddhist society. Number two was the Astronomical Society, because I was always interested in the stars, and you had these great resources. I had a whole telescope there, which they discovered one of the major planets there. And because they don't use visual satellites anymore, they use radio telescopes, it was abandoned, and so the students could go and play with it. I remember one evening just going out there, just after, for those of you old enough, 2001, A Space Odyssey, saw that with my friends, and afterwards say, hey, let's go out to the observatory, because I was a member, we can go and sit in the chair and watch all these amazing stars. I remember seeing Saturn up there, just first time I actually saw Saturn live with all its rings. Not a picture, you're actually there watching it. It's amazing. But anyway, the third society I joined was the Psychic Research Society, where we investigated ghosts. Because I loved that sort of stuff. I wasn't so afraid. I was intrigued and interested. All these things of ghosts, do they really exist? And if they do, what are they? How are they? And so we had this great society, had these marvelous lectures, and also so that's where I made friends with this fellow, Dr. Tony Cornell, who became the head ghost hunter of Great Britain and Northern Ireland. He had this amazing business card he would give out to you, Dr. Tony Cornell, head ghost hunter. And he was. It wasn't just a joke. He was this huge society of professors and scientists in London. Now, he had such experience that he was the number one expert on ghosts in UK. And every now and again, reading a Sunday paper, here in Perth, you'd see some article about a haunting in England, because there's lots of ghosts in England, and he would be the expert they'd interview to find out. And he was a great friend. 2 or 3 years ago, when I went to visit London, I had lunch with him. So, you know, still sort of keep up and see what's going on with him. And he spent his whole life investigating these things. An amazing sort of man to talk with, and a great sense of humour as well. But one thing which he told me, which I've known ever since I was part of the society in Cambridge, never once has a ghost ever harmed anybody. Never once. In all the research they've done in UK, over 130, 40 years, the ghosts can scare you, they can terrify you, but they can't harm you at all. No one knows why, but that seems to be the rule. So, if you do see a ghost, please, 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 don't be afraid. If you dream of a ghost, remember this story, because sometimes ghosts can come in your dreams and help you. This is a story of the tsunami ghost. I think I've told this a year or two ago, but there's always a turnover of people who come to this center. So, when I tell this story, shall we turn the lights down? No, perhaps not, otherwise you won't be able to see me on the... Again, these are true stories. This was, actually, for those of you who know Ajahn Yanadamo, the Somali monk who stayed for many years in Perth, who's now over in Thailand, this was one of his close disciples, told this true story. 3 days after the tsunami hit Thailand, there was a Thai girl who lived in the town of Grabi, had a dream in the middle of the night. And the dream was of this English girl coming up to her. But this English girl, her hair, blonde hair, was all tangled and tousled. And her face, she must have been quite a young girl, 19, 20 or whatever, was all bruised and gashed. And her body was all broken with huge gashes and blood in it. Imagine seeing that, this bloody bruised corpse coming to you in your dream. Ah. But because it's in a dream, you know, you're too sleepy for actually to be too afraid. And the ghost kept saying, "Help me, help me, help me." And the ghost said, "I was on Phi Phi Island when the wave hit. I'm dead." And at this moment, she said, "Thai soldiers are lifting up my body and they're placing me in a temple, a Buddhist temple in Bangkok," and she said the name of that temple. "And my mother, who lives in London, is desperately trying to call me on my mobile phone. But my phone is at the bottom of the ocean. Please help me. Can you do 2 things for me?" said the ghost. "First, I want a Buddhist funeral. I'm not a Buddhist, but I want a Buddhist cremation. Can you arrange that for me? This is my name, this is the temple where my body is right now. And number 2, can you please ask my mother not to come until the cremation is over? I don't want her to see me like this. Please, can you do this for me? And here is my mother's telephone number." And she gave this long list of digits, after which this Thai girl woke up. Middle of the night, she was married to an Englishman. Maybe that's why this ghost came to see her. So she woke up her husband and told her the dream, which she had perfect recall of. And the husband was surprised because the telephone number was a legitimate London phone number. So he said, "Call it." She said, "No, call it." So they rang the number. Middle of the night in Thailand, late afternoon, early evening in London, a woman picked up that phone. It's a true story. A woman picked up that phone. After a short conversation, it was the mother of a girl who was missing on Phi Phi Island. It was that ghost's mother. The name, description was perfect. So the mother was thankful, at least now she knew for sure what she expected deep in her heart. If you are a mother, sometimes you can feel whether your child is alive or dead when they go missing. So she gave permission for them to do the funeral service and to let her know when it was completed so she could come and collect her daughter's ashes. The next morning they went to Phuket, found the temple, found the body, got permission to do the ceremony, and cremated the corpse. They said that the body looked exactly as it did in the dream. And having done the cremation, the mother from London came on an aircraft from Heathrow. They met at Phuket airport, handed over the ashes, cried, and then the mother went home. And the Thai girl went home with her husband to Grabi. And a couple of nights later, they had another dream. And in this dream, the girl came to the this English girl came to this Thai girl again in a dream. But this time, her hair was immaculate, as if she'd been to Elizabeth Arden's or something. I don't know. Are they still in business, Elizabeth Arden's? It's been a long time since I went to any hairdresser. I do my own. But like the best hairdresser in town, just beautiful hair. And her face, no bruises, no cuts, as if she had like makeover. And her dress, white and shining, immaculate. And she said in a dream, look what's happened to me. Look what you've done for me. I'm a heavenly being, an angel. Thank you so much for arranging that ceremony for me. And thank you so much for letting my mother know. I've come here one more time to say thank you to you. Thank you so much. To express my gratitude, said this angel in the dream. Here is another set of numbers. Which she also remembered when she woke up. But they never tried to dial those numbers. Because if you all suspect, that was not a phone number. That was a lottery number. Which won. And they made quite a substantial amount of money. And that is a true story. The moral of that story is, if ever you see a ghost, don't run away yet. Ask it for some numbers first, and then run like hell. We're in a dream. Don't get afraid. Come on, let's have some numbers, please. But remember, because you heard that story in Dhammaloka Buddhist Center, 10% of your winnings should go to the temple. But anyhow, so sometimes these dreams actually work out to be true. And sometimes these are ways where actually beings can actually contact, especially if they're recently dead beings. Because a lot of times it happens, and this is serious stuff, I mean, you lose someone in death. And it's tragic because even though we know we should be letting go of people and we have to let go, we know we can't keep our loved ones forever. Nevertheless, because we're not enlightened beings yet, when somebody close to you dies, we do feel a lot of sadness, a lot of grief. Now imagine it was you who died. Now you still care for your, you know, your wife, your husband, your relations, your friends. So what would you like to do when you die? The first thing you want to do is actually to go and see your loved ones, the ones who are still living, and say, look, I'm okay, I'm fine. Just, you sort of take it easy, don't worry about me. Look after yourselves, we had a wonderful time now, now I have to leave. Please, you look after yourself. And sometimes those beings who have freshly died, they want to look after their loved ones, as obviously you would like to, so much, that the only time they can gain access to you is when all your defenses are down in a dream state. You know, but when you're sort of alert enough just before you wake up to actually be able to be contacted. So it's not that uncommon. I have many sort of tales of recently deceased people contacting their wife, their husband, their children or their mother or something in a dream state. And you get some very interesting information here. One of the fascinating tales, and this is why we have a ceremony in Buddhism for 49 days, to make merit for the deceased, transfer merits or whatever. Because in Buddhism they say, 49 days, the person who's died can still be around. Listening, hearing, and being able to be contacted by you, as if that gives like a time before you have to go and get on your next life, a little like a waiting time before you can go off to your next existence. And in this particular story, when I was in Thailand, disciple of the monastery, the whole family were very devout disciples of the monastery. The father was the treasurer of our monastery. And one of his daughters got cancer, very young, only in her 20s. Every treatment didn't work, and sometimes it happens that way. It's like, must be some karma from the past or something. No treatment manages to stop the cancer. It got worse and worse and worse, until she eventually died. But she died very well, because she'd been coming to temple a long time and meditating a lot, Never underestimate the power of meditation, especially when the chips are down, when your body's breaking up, you've got cancer or pain or whatever. It's amazing what meditation can do just to make those last days so peaceful and so happy. She'd never complain because her mind was powerful enough to let go of the pain, no fear of dying. She died beautifully. But because she was a disciple of the monastery, after her death, we did a funeral ceremony. And it was a few weeks later that the father came and saw me just very early in the morning in the monastery. He came up to me. It's a personal story. And he said, I asked him, what is he doing at the monastery so early? And he said, because something happened early this morning, he got so afraid, he took the first possible, not really a truck it was, to the monastery to come and speak to somebody about it. What happened? I said. And he said, we were having our breakfast in Thailand, in Asia, especially 30, 40 years ago. People put the food on the ground. They all sit around it and they just take a bit here, take a bit there. And they talk to each other. It's all done on the ground. And this is a big family, maybe 13, 14, 15 people, I can't remember the exact number. They were having their breakfast, chatting about all sorts of things. And one of the daughters, one of his other daughters, said, oh, I had a dream about my sister last night. She came up to me and said, I've been here long enough. I'm taking leave. I'm going now. And when she said that, very simple statement, everybody around that table stopped eating. And one by one, they all recounted having exactly the same dream that night. About 14 or 15 people had precisely the same dream. And it was so strange. Coincidences, it was impossible as a coincidence. So he got on the next truck and came to the monastery to try and see me. He said, what's going on? I said, she's come to take leave. What do you think? And the only way she can do that is in a dream state when, you know, you guys are not fearful enough and not protecting your mind enough to be able to be reached by a person like that. But the interesting thing was, as soon as he left, because I knew all the details of, you know, her sickness, when she died, when the cremation was, I looked in the calendar. It was precisely 49 days. 49 days, and then she took leave to go. It's as if people do that. They hang around for a while to make sure the family and friends are all safe and happy and everything else is settled before they will disappear. And also sometimes they stay around just in case there's been some funny business. For example, there was a Thai Chinese girl here, very strong supporter of our temple, but her husband, who was Chinese, she did not trust him at all. So much so that when she was about a year before she died, she came up to me and said, look, I don't trust this guy. He said, I don't even think he'll pay for my funeral. So he said, I'm going to leave a will that half of my estate will go to my husband. The other half will go to the Buddhist Society here on one condition, that you arrange the funeral service and the Buddhist Society pays for it. So I took her over my committee. So I said, you know, fair enough, if that's what you want to do. So we had a will. We'd pay for the Buddhist Society here from our funds. We'd pay for the funeral service for this lady in return that half of her estate. She only had a small house in Maylands. So we agreed on that. She died. And if I make a promise, I keep it. So, you know, even if the Buddhist Society sort of, you know, wouldn't do it, but the Buddhist Society, we also keep our promises. So we did a funeral service for him. And we're not sort of all that materialistically minded, so we never sort of bothered the husband about the will. But then after 3 or 4 weeks, we asked him, oh, you know, he's got that sort of will. He said, oh, actually, I've been looking for it. I can't find it. So never mind. And then a couple of weeks later, have you found the will? Oh, I haven't found the will at all. No, it's lost. I don't know what's happened to it. And then a few days later, he came to the monastery. I've got the will. Oh, where did you find it? And he said, I woke up in the middle of the night. And I heard my wife, George, get the will. Here it is, please take it. He knew where it was, but he needed his wife to come in the middle of the night and scare him to bits.
He couldn't give us that will quick enough.
So sometimes you've got to be very careful. If you promise something, sometimes the ghost may make sure that you do that. But sometimes they can come in a dream. But remember, most of the dreams which actually happen are just not really prognostic at all. They just give you some insight into actually what's happening in your day and what's happening in your mind. And so anybody who actually tells or interprets dreams, it's really interpreting just, you know, the mind state, the facts of the matter, what you actually dream of. You know, they're not so important as your emotional reaction to that dream and just what you make of that dream, whether it's being afraid or being worried. That tells you much more about you rather than the dream. And that's one of the best things about dreams. It gives you an insight into the state of your mind and how you're dealing with life and what's going on inside of you. And in the spiritual path, that can be quite useful. It's not so much what you're dreaming of, but how you react to it and what sort of parts of that dream you remember. Because you know that, you know, many of you have known me for a while, I'm like a fun-loving monk, sometimes a bit of a joker. But I remember one of my own favourite dreams, the one which I remember probably more than any other dream I've had, is that one night I dreamt of having this great psychic battle with this Hindu saint, Hindu monk. And we're flying, it's a great dream, it's just so vivid, flying up through the air and zapping each other with psychic lasers and having this amazing fight. But it was just for fun. So that's the sort of, you know, I'm a very playful monk, so my dreams, that's the sort of dreams I have, having psychic battles in the air with Hindu meditators. Really good fun. But I also remember just having some really great meditation sometime. I remember sometimes, you know, the meditation which we do, you know, getting the mind really, really still, and getting huge amounts of energy up to these beautiful lights we call the nimittas, and then going to these incredible deep meditation states. I remember just, you know, having some really good stretch of meditation once, and even in my dream, just dreaming of these great nimittas, these beautiful lights in your mind. And as soon as you see this light, you get so much energy, you wake up and just have a nice meditation. So even in dreams you can meditate. So that's, you know, my type of meditation. You meditate having psychic battles against some powerful deep meditations. So that's really nice. So if you can't actually get these jhanas in real life, you can actually dream of them and have really great fun. Best dreams you can get. But anyhow, this just actually shows you what you're doing at that time, what's happening in your life in that day. It gives you a way of reflecting on what's happening. But the most important thing, if ever you have like bad dreams, which sometimes people do, they have bad dreams or they wake up in the middle of the night, a lot of the time it's anxiety, worry, fear, guilt, whatever, something is negative emotions playing on your brain. So people who suffer those bad dreams, the way to overcome them is when you go to sleep at night. Really, what you put in your brain just before you go to sleep, that's almost like a seed, like a yeast, which can actually multiply, you know, in the dream state and make these terrible dreams. So what's really interesting and useful, even what the Buddha suggested 2,500 years ago, if you're subject to these, you know, really bad or debilitating dreams, laying down in bed, you rest it before you go to sleep. Start developing some positive states of mind. You know, like thinking of like loving kindness or compassion, the most peaceful time you've ever had. Just, you know, thinking about sort of, you know, anything which is peaceful, happy, inspiring, spiritual, if you like. If you're a devout Buddhist, you can think of a Buddha or think of the favorite monks or nuns. Think of some amazing peaceful experiences. If you put that into your mind as you go to bed, then before you go to sleep, you have beautiful dreams, or no dreams at all, because you sleep very deeply. It's actually how you program your sleep state. And that's exactly how you program your mind before you die. Now, what you put into the mind just before you pass from this life to another life, that is crucial. Just as you pass from this waking state to this sleep state, see if you can put some positive thoughts in the mind. For example, if you remember like a joke before you go to sleep, you'd have some very, very hilarious dreams. if you have some beautiful loving kindness, some inspirational story which, you know, happened to you that day, you remember, then you have like an inspiring sort of night's sleep. It's actually what you put into the mix just before you go to sleep. That's what's most important. So really you can control those dreams in the sense of like influencing them. So be careful. You may have had a difficult day, a bad time, a painful time. But be careful, please don't take that into your sleep state with you. Just let it go outside before you actually go to sleep. Substitute those negative thoughts or negative emotions, those bad memories, with something positive. Even if you're worried about something which is going to happen tomorrow. And maybe tomorrow you're about to be executed. Or you're about to sort of have a terrible operation, or something terrible is going to happen to you tomorrow morning. Don't sort of take that into sleep with you. In other words, you don't know what's going to happen in the future. Who knows what's going to happen in the future? The future is totally uncertain. One of my favorite stories, this is from the Sufi tradition, because it's this great monk. If any of you want to sort of know really beautiful Islam, go in the internet, go and get a book on Nasruddin the Mullah. He was a great fellow, very hilarious, and also some very wise sayings of Nasruddin. So he was like, you know, a wise guy in the time of the Shah of Iran, many hundreds of years ago, and beautiful stories about this guy. And anyway, that once he'd said something wrong, like, you know, in those days, you know, if it was like I was living in those days, I'd get sort of put in jail a long time ago for some of the things I say. But this guy, he got away with it for many years. He said something which was heretical. And so one, some of his enemies took him up on that, took him to court. It was obvious he was guilty. There's no way out. So the Shah said, look, I really like you. You're great fun. You really entertain me. You're very wise. But law is the law. You've got no alternative. I have to condemn you to death. You've got to be executed. Have your head cut off. And this Mullah Nasruddin said, oh, that's such a shame. I was just about to teach your donkey how to fly. Really weird. And the Shah said, the Shah of Persia said, you can teach donkeys how to fly? He said, oh yeah, but I need a bit of time. I can't do it just overnight. The Shah said, okay, I will stay your execution for 12 months so you can teach my donkey how to fly. If you teach my donkey how to fly, you're free. But if you don't teach my donkey how to fly, in 12 months' time you'll be executed, okay? And he said, yeah, sure, fine, thanks very much. So he got a stay of execution for 12 months to teach the Shah's donkey how to fly. Another way out from court, one of his friends said, that's amazing, I never realized anyone could teach a donkey how to fly. And Nasruddin said, yeah, you're right, no one can teach donkeys how to fly. Well, why do you say that for? I've got an extra 12 months to live. The Shah could die in 6 months, I might die in 9 months. Who knows what's going to happen in 12 months' time? I'm a winner. And that's a wonderful little story there about sort of the uncertainty of the future. So when you are going to sleep, you don't know what's going to happen next. One thing I can promise you about the future is always things you don't expect. They're what happens. I never expected to be like a monk sitting up here and just talking to people all day. I thought I'd always be in a cave alone, this little hermit having a wonderful time, deep meditation. And many years ago I dreamt, because I heard, you know, in the Nullarbor there's lots of caves there. And the one thing about living alone as a hermit, you can do without food for many days, but one thing you can't do without is water. You need water. And apparently in some of those caves under the Nullarbor, there's like water, underground water there. So I thought, wow, that's what I'd do. I'd say, you know, I'd forget about being an abbot, spiritual director, and all these committee meetings and AGMs, which by the way is tomorrow, AGM tomorrow, at 4:30. Instead of having all these AGMs, I'd be like a hermit. I'll find a nice cave in the Nullarbor and go and stay in there. You know, maybe 3 or 4 days, go out to a roadhouse and get some food and get some support. You know, people actually pay the bill. And I just eat maybe 1 or 3 or 4 days and just go into deep meditation and just have water to drink and wash. I thought, what a beautiful life that would be. But then I started thinking, what would actually happen if I did that? Sooner or later, somebody would find me. And when they find me, they'd do an article about me. Because it's newsworthy, it's odd. Like, you know, sort of like a person who was from England, a Buddhist monk, sitting in a cave alone for all that time. You know, that's the sort of stuff, you know, you see on the weekend supplements, you know, in the West Australian or the Australian. That's newsworthy. And so, of course, after they get in the first newspaper, then, of course, who next would go there? 60 Minutes. They get a TV crew to go there to interview, you know, the hermit of the Nullarbor. And once it gets on TV, then, of course, you know, you start to become a bit famous. Then all the tour buses would actually make a detour. So they could go and actually see, because it's interesting, go and see the Hermit of the Nullarbor, maybe have some wise things to say, and have your picture taken with the Hermit of the Nullarbor. And then after that, they'd have a little shop in front of your cave, selling Devonshire teas and little models of the Hermit of the Nullarbor, which you can put in the back of your car, and a little sort of sticker, I've seen the Hermit of the Nullarbor. And that would be the end of my hermit days. So you realize you just can't do those sorts of things. So one thing which I know now, you don't actually plan your life, you just, you know, just let it happen, stop arguing with it. Because it's all out of control, you should know that now. You're old enough now to know that all this controlling business just makes matters worse. You know, you might as well just accept it, accept your lot in life, and just make fun with it, make the best out of it. So, you know, you don't tend to sort of control your life anymore. Maybe just nudge it this way, nudge it that way, but make the best out of it and have fun with it, no matter what you have to do in life. So that means you don't worry about things. You know, that, for example, that in four weeks today, we're having the opening ceremony of our Jhana Grove Retreat Center. This huge $5 million project for our retreat center. We're starting our retreat then. Some of you have already booked to go on that retreat. It might not be ready in time. The builders are still cement all over the place. There's still many things left to be done. Electricity, the water's not on yet, the water tank's on. And the council, they've got to approve all sorts of health things which haven't been done yet. So am I worried? No, I've always got a plan B. I've got an air ticket out just in case. It's not finished. On the 10th, I'm over to an undisclosed destination. So you just make the best of whatever happens, so you don't worry about things. But one thing you do know is the future is totally unpredictable. Sure, you can have these dreams, like the five angels. Yeah, they may be real dreams, but do you know really what they mean? You only know what it means after the event sometimes. And that's the difficulty with prognostications or with omens. No one really knows for sure. And that's one of the beautiful parts of life. If you really did know what was going to happen, that would make life so terrible. The fact you don't know makes one life interesting, makes mindfulness more important, more aware. Okay, no, 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 what's going to happen next. And makes this whole spiritual path focused in this present moment. This is where you're making the future. You don't know what it's going to be, how it's going to be. But if you really put forth a lot of love, I mean real selfless love, care, compassion, peace, right into whatever you're doing in every moment, right now, you know you're doing the very, very best for a beautiful future. As I mentioned during the meditation, this right here, right now, is where you are making your future. You're building your future right now. So how can you make the best possible future? By putting positive qualities into this very moment. If you're afraid or anxious right now, it's negativity. You're creating a negative scenario for your future. This is how you create future. In Buddhism we call this karma. This is how you make your world. And you make it right now. So even when you go to sleep tonight, put forth beautiful, positive, spiritual things in your mind in this moment when you're going to sleep. And you know you're doing your very, very best for a beautiful, positive sleep, a happy, restful sleep, being refreshed in the morning. And you know you're doing the very, very best for your health, prosperity, peace, and happiness for the future. It's actually how you sleep. And these days, so often that people do get sick, and sometimes you've got so many things to do, it's because we don't sleep well. Wouldn't it be wonderful to sleep like a baby every night, with no worries? Can you do that? Why not? If you've understood some of what's been said here tonight, it's not just about the funny stories about dreams. It's actually how to sleep, and how to sleep well. You go to bed and let go of all the past and all the future. Don't worry about things, because that will just create bad dreams. Future's uncertain. Let's wait until tomorrow to see what it's going to be. Past, it's all dead stuff. Finished with. Can't change it. Good or bad, it's all gone. Let it go. And all the kindness, the joy, the peace in this moment, that's all you can do. Make peace with this moment. Be kind to it. Be gentle. And you do the very, very, very best. If you do that before you go to sleep, you always have a very deep and restful sleep. So you wake up in the morning, really are refreshed. Your body's refreshed. Your mind is raring to go. You can be far more efficient in your life when you know how to sleep well and rest deeply. This is what you can do. Present moment, no past, no future. Stop thinking about things. Shh. Just rest with the body. And then you never need to have a sleeping tablet ever again. And you can wake up in the morning, instead of being grumpy, sibbity-doo-dah! Another wonderful day! Woo, yeah! Monday morning, back to work! Woo, yeah! Saturday morning, yeah, at AGM! Woo, let's go for it! Sunday, food fair! Woo, whoopee! Instead of, got to get out of food fair today. Why did I get myself into this? Don't do things like that. Keep the positive energy in every moment. That's the best thing you can do. Beautiful dreams or no dreams at all. You sleep so deeply. And that's the best possible thing you can do. So that's a little talk this evening on dreams and other things of life. So I hope you enjoyed it, because that's all you're getting. Thank you very much for listening. So, is there any questions or comments? Did anyone go to sleep and have a nice dream during my talk this evening? You got a comment, yeah.
I understand that when we are asleep, we are not in the body. When you call it spirit or ghost or whatever, we are not in the body.
Ah.
Our body, which is lying in bed, but not us.
Are you saying that when you're asleep, is your mind really in the body? Are you sort of physically in here, or you're sort of in another place? Most times, no, you're not in any other place, you're just in fantasy world. But sometimes people do actually, as it were, leave the body in sleep. But that's quite rare to do that. Can be done, sometimes is done, but it's usually quite rare. Most times when people are in the body, they may dream that they're in some other place. But if you check out, the things which you dreamt of didn't really happen. So it is made up by the mind. But sometimes you do leave the body. But it is rare that that's the case. It's great, you can actually check it up. So, for example, you can, if you want to come and visit me tonight. And then you can actually see on which side do I go to sleep at night. And you can check out and see if it was true or not. It's great to check these things out. Because there's such a thing as like these astral travelling. You probably all heard these cases, seen them on the documentaries of people like leaving their bodies when they were dead on the operating table. And this lady, the famous tennis shoe thing. She left her body when doing an operation and went high up in this operating theatre. And they had these like high windows. Well, we haven't got high windows here, but like in the community hall of next door, high windows here. And actually she saw a tennis shoe was on the ledge of a window of the operating theatre. And it could not be seen from down below. And when she came back, she said, oh, by the way, there's a tennis shoe on the ledge. What's a tennis shoe doing in the operating theatre? Can't be. But of course, he's insisted on it, and of course, they had a look. It was actually a tennis shoe up there. It was a fascinating piece of evidence because it was something which really shouldn't be there. No one could imagine it. It's just sort of a pot plant or a spider's web, you know, that could be there by chance. But a tennis shoe on that ledge, completely sort of unpredictable. And she saw it, so she did leave her body. Well, that's rare, to have a real leaving of the body. Yes? Oh, yeah, no. When you meditate deeply, you're saying in some places you go to, they say, don't meditate because you can leave your body and you don't come back. It's very, number one, it's very rare that anybody leaves their body when they're meditating. It's very, very rare. And if you don't meditate, it's far more dangerous. Meditation, ask any doctor, it's good for this part of the health, that part of the health. It's not dangerous. As I mentioned when I was in Indonesia last week, it's far more dangerous not to meditate. That's really dangerous because you get angry, you get sort of tense, you get heart disease, cancers. Look at all the information which scientists have amassed. The benefits of meditation are huge, which is why there probably be many people here who have come to meditation because it's been sent by their doctors. Not to be religious at all, this is just basic. But if anybody does leave their body, they can come back again. I don't know of any case where I've been a monk for 34, 35 years, been teaching meditation a long time. I haven't known one case in all my life as a meditator when someone has left their body during meditation and haven't come back again. Yeah. So you'll be fine. Guaranteed. Money back. But be careful because some people are fear merchants. They always make you scared. You know, if you don't do this, you'll get in big trouble. You know, if you don't come to our food fair on Sunday, I wouldn't know what your chances are going to be. But we don't do fear in this place. We don't sort of, because fear is a way of controlling people. We don't do that. And people who use fear to control you, that's just unethical, immoral. So they say that, number one, it's not true. Number two, they're being unethical to use fear. Meditation is great. Look how many people come and meditate here. How many people have actually left their body and didn't come back this evening? Zero. So it's very, 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 very safe. One last question from Eddie at the back. Correct, yeah. Exactly what I've been saying. He was saying he read somewhere in the Buddha scriptures that when the monks asked the Buddha about what's the significance of dreams, the Buddha said, look, don't pay too much attention to them, for 95% of them aren't true. So that's correct. That's just what I said. But every now and again, some are true. And even the Buddha, sort of, he had this great dream that his head was on the Himalaya mountains. He was facing east and his feet were pointing south. And people often look at the significance of that because we have these dreams and it's up to us to interpret them. And I've told many people, you know, in Sri Lanka, in Thailand, Indonesia, Malaysia, Singapore, the meaning of that dream was the way your feet are pointing, that's where you're going to be traveling. So his feet were pointing south to Australia. So that's where the Buddha was going to go. Obvious.